Good morning.
Good morning.
How happy I am to be with you today. I just walked in the door and all of the good stuff flooded back from the last year. I am now ordained a deacon in the Episcopal Church. And there is no one in the last few years who can take more credit for having formed me for this role than Epiphany Burnett can. You all have loved me, given me a chance to serve you, instructed me, and gently, and sometimes firmly, pointed out opportunities that I have to grow as a minister. And I am delighted to be back at a place that I associate with preparation for what God is calling me to do. So it is really, really great to be with you. These days, I am serving St. John's Episcopal Church in Columbus, Texas, which is right where Highway 71 meets I-10 on the way to Houston. It is a small congregation of about 10 people, a really promising and fruitful mix of perspective and backgrounds. And we are doing fun stuff. And the attitude of this congregation is, what do we have to work with? Very much the story of the loaves and fishes. They see people around in the community who need God's love, and they're just asking themselves, what do we have to share? What do we have to make communion with for these folks? So it is if you are ever in Columbus on a Sunday morning, text me or let me know so that I can look for you. My family has a farm near there, and so Eugene and his people and I are together most of the weekends that I'm serving, and it is a great connection for me to have with that community. I am wearing stuff that you all paid for today, so I want to be able to thank you in person for the incredibly generous gift that this church made to equip me with clothes for ministry. I've got underneath this a shirt with a collar that you'll see afterwards that was also a gift from you all. And I'm going to be gradually building up that set of signs and tools thanks to your generosity. So it is, I feel like I'm wearing your love on me all the time that I'm serving. And one last thing, when I was ordained at Christ Church Cathedral in Houston in June, because there was already someone from St. James Episcopal Church in Austin that was using the St. James kneeler, I got to kneel on the Epiphany Burnett kneeler, and I sent Father Michael a picture of this, and I was full of kind of unexpectedly emotion from being connected with you all in that way, in that really important moment. So I carry you with me in my ministry in many ways, and the love that you showed me in Jesus is now love that I'm able to show other people. And I look forward to the day, God willing, in early 2024, when I will have the final step of ordination to the priesthood and be able to come back and celebrate that with you all also. I'm going to be providing all the information about that ordination for anybody who wants to come to Austin and be part of that party, which I promise you, through no act of mine, is already out of control. And you would like to be part of that and would be incredibly welcome as important people that we'd be celebrating what you've done. This passage that we've drawn this morning feels to me one of the most important instructions in Christian discipleship. And it's hard to think of one that has more relevance for the world we're living in. On one hand, because of the sheer amount of loneliness that is around us among people. I was lucky to be part of a study with a group of doctors from Dell Medical a couple of years ago in the middle of the pandemic. We had these folks in metropolitan Dallas who were clients of Meals on Wheels. They got the meals delivered to them. And these folks agreed to take part in a study where they would receive a phone call once a week from a college student who was volunteering to support the science team. And the college student would call to just visit with these folks. And we trained the college students to only follow three rules in this conversation. You can talk about whatever you want for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, but there are three things that we're asking you to do as the person who's calling, as the person who is listening. The first thing we're asking you to do is to follow the clues of the person who's talking to you. The person who's receiving Meals on Wheels might say something like, "My family is coming this weekend." And that's probably a signal that they'd like to tell you a story. So ask, "Tell me about your family." The second thing we told them to do was to ask open-ended questions instead of yes-no questions. Open-ended questions like, "What's your family like? What do you all like to do together?" As opposed to, "Do you have kids?" There's something about yes-no questions we've learned make people feel interrogated or checked on. As one of my mentors used to say, every yes-no question is a version of, "Did you clean your room?" or, "Do you still love me?" Problematic. The third rule we told them to follow was to make sure that you make one point per turn. And when you make one point, then hand off back. "What's your family like?" Stop. "Sounds like you really enjoy your grandchildren." Stop. "Sounds like that was a really hard conversation." Stop. My grandmother used to say, "One point is a conversation, 2 points is a speech." When we finished this study, what we found was that we had tested all of the participants at the beginning, and when we tested them again at the end, they showed remarkable reductions in their levels of loneliness. That receiving 4 weeks worth of phone calls where the people were asking questions and listening to them in this careful way actually lowered people's experience of feeling lonely. And there are a lot of people that have tried these phone call experiments before without changing the mental health of the people that were participating. So we started getting a lot of calls from people saying, what happened on these calls that was special? Why did you get results and our study didn't? And it has to do not so much with the fact that people were calling, but with the quality of attention that they were offering, with the way they were being present, with the way they were listening, and what they were doing with what people were giving them. This to me seems to be important because the way we're present with people right now in an epidemic of loneliness might allow them to experience a love, even in a small phone call, that's completely nourishing or life-saving. Another reason that this passage seems so vital right now is just the sheer amount of conflict that we're dealing with every day. And it's not just that we disagree about stuff. It's not that people hold differences of opinion. But as Amanda Ripley, the journalist and student of conflict, points out, it's because we've allowed ourselves to get shifted over into high conflict. High conflict is when it's not just that we're disagreeing on issues, it's that we've really decided we're disgusted with each other. We've moved past the ability to have a conversation, to see each other's points of view, and into a world in which it's us and them, good and evil, two different sides. And once you're in that world, Amanda Ripley points out, the conflict starts to have a life of its own. We can even forget about what we're arguing about, because we're so caught up in being right. We're so caught up in being on the right side. We're so caught up in even the spirituality of the fight. It becomes its own religion, even, Amanda Ripley points out. And the only way out of that is for us to recover any kind of curiosity, what we don't know about folks that we have begun to label and even demonize. And it seems to me that that dynamic, it's not even that it's dangerous, it's that it's just exhausting. And those of us that have been in it for a long time are kind of bored with it. I'm actually willing to try almost anything else. And for that reason, I'm really thankful for every opportunity that I get, whether it's in my work or through my family or in unexpected encounters in my life, to make friends with people who just don't think like me, folks that otherwise might be on the other side. And yet, that is not easy work. It's exhausting, it's triggering, it is discouraging, even as at moments it's exhilarating and encouraging and promising and ecstatic. And that's what Ripley writes in her book, High Conflict. She said, as we began to build skills for this kind of being with other people, we discover that it is, hard as it is, work worth doing. Now this morning, Paul is writing to the church in Rome with some of the words that I find to be most beautiful in their way of summing up what we're doing as followers of Jesus. That the entirety of the law, everything, and he starts to name all the commandments, don't covet, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery. He names them. He goes, it's all summed up in loving your neighbor. If you are loving your neighbor, you are fulfilling the law. And all of us who found our way to the Episcopal Church from more repressive Christian fellowships love this version because it's not about the rules. It's about love. It's about love. It's direct. It's clear. Love is the priority, and the rules are not the point. I agree. I find that liberating, too. I also find it profoundly challenging. Because what is actually loving my neighbor? I think that's what Jesus is talking about this morning. When he gives us, in this Gospel of Matthew, the only instruction I hear from Jesus anywhere in any of the Gospels that's directed to the church. This is the only place where Jesus is saying, when you're in the church, this is the rule that I want you to follow with each other. The rest of his teachings are broad teachings to all disciples, all of us, about the nature of the kingdom of heaven and the Father in heaven. But this is the rule of life that he's giving to those of us who would dare follow him in baptism and in the communal life of the church. He says, when somebody sins against you, go. When somebody sins against you, go. So this starts to me with a very big challenge to make myself vulnerable when someone has hurt me or wronged me. I'm already ready to push back. And he continues, go and tell this person about it when you are alone. Now, that is definitely not the rule of life I typically follow. I like to go process this with a lot of other people before I go talk to this person. But Jesus says, go to them. Go to them when you are alone and talk. And notice what he says next. And if they listen, you have regained them. This is what I have found mysterious in my few efforts to really practice this teaching of our Lord, is that I actually don't need people to agree with me. I actually don't need people to agree with me. I don't even need them to apologize. When they have wronged me, it is sometimes enough that we have sat together and they have heard me. It is sometimes enough that I have had the experience of sitting with them, they have listened, because it is that listening that affects our brain chemistry. It is that listening that changes our mental health. It is that listening through which the Holy Spirit enters what is otherwise stuck or broken. And I don't know that we can say much more about this miracle of how relationship is healed or how God over time gives us love and the Holy Spirit for one another. But what Jesus says here that is most challenging to me is, if they listen, you have regained that one. I find this almost so unbelievable that I have had to test it to trust it. And I would encourage that where we see the opportunity, and do not start with the hardest case. Do not start with the worst offender. Do not start with the grudge that you've held the longest. Start with just any case of minor annoyance and just see what happens. And if they won't listen, then take one or two people with you. And why are you taking these people? Not so you can gang up. You're taking these people so that we can be witnesses together. Witnesses that something holy is happening here by our openness to the Spirit. That is what we are witnessing. We are witnessing presence. I've had this experience also. This experience of sitting with friends as I was with someone where we had damaging tension between us. And I do not remember any agreement being crafted, but I remember the powerful presence of a spirit of openness and receptivity and hope. And that was enough to relieve me of a burden that I was carrying. That was enough to cause me no longer to go out of my way to avoid someone in a way that was damaging to the community. They don't have to agree. They don't even have to listen necessarily. Other people are listening for us. And it is that listening that lets the Spirit in. And if things remain unhealed, then say it to the church. And if the church is not able to bring the Spirit to restore harmony, restore communion in this case, then treat this person as you would a Gentile or a tax collector. And the part of me that loves high conflict is really glad to have a blank check to write some folks off. And that is not at all what Jesus is saying. Jesus is not giving us an out. Because Jesus has shown us throughout his ministry how to be with Gentiles, how to be with tax collectors. Jesus has always taken up for the tax collectors. He's going to their houses. He invites one of them to be one of the 12. Jesus is a friend of the tax collectors and the sinners. Jesus is going to the Gentiles in response to their needs. He raises their children and their servants. He casts out the demons from their children. Jesus, even though he says, "I came for the lost sheep of Israel," he rewards the faith of the Gentiles by extending God's power to them in a foretaste of how they would be brought into the church. So treating someone like a Gentile or a tax collector is a pretty tall order. It is a demanding way of loving other folks. I think that it's in the context of how serious this rule of life is, how there really is no excuse. Even if I don't start with the hardest case, I can't put this rule completely on the shelf. I've got to keep testing it so that God can change me through the practice. And I think it's through that practice that we come to understand what these last mysterious sentences mean. That what we bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And that whatever two people agree on will be done for them by Jesus' Father who is in heaven. These are mysterious passages that can't mean exactly what they look like to our greedy eyes when we want more control over God. But they might be saying that if we are working diligently in faith to let more holy agreement emerge among us, we become more powerful as God's instruments to do God's work in the world. There are a lot of lonely people that are in their own way praying that God's love might find them. And the way we go and listen is a sign that God has not forgotten them. And as we know from science, just that much might save someone's life. There is a lot of conflict and people that are caught in a spirit that divides even as it eats us up with a kind of addictive pattern. And today we're hearing about a way of listening that dissolves that, that loosens it, and strikes a blow against it as a spirit that can take over communities and countries. It's a hard teaching. It's a challenging rule. It is not negotiable. It is Jesus' priority in the view of Matthew's community that we practice that way as tension arises, not to make ourselves more comfortable, but to make ourselves more available to the God whom we have fallen in love with, the God that we are trusting to save us, and the God who, through us, would save the world. Thanks be to God.